Like the conversations you hear on Basic Folk with your favorite roots artists? Then join Back Catalog Listening Party, a weekly podcast where you can dig deeper into their catalog. Top songwriters like Mary Gaucher, Chris Smither, Dar Williams, and Lizzie Ngo join host Mother Banjo and Anthony Earig to talk about their old albums with a live online audience. Listen wherever you get your podcasts and learn about attending live tapings at backcataloglisteningparty.com/join. Well, hello and welcome to Basic Folk, where we have honest conversations with folk musicians on the Bluegrass Situation podcast network. I'm Cindy House and I host this podcast. Very happy that you've decided to check out the show today. We have a big one. That's right. Greg Brown is on Basic Folk today. Before we get into that, I just have a couple of things to tell you about. If you are not on Basic Folk's monthly newsletter, might you be so inclined to sign up for it? You can at the link in the show notes, or you can go to basicfolk.com. It's a once a month email that lets you know what's going on with the podcast, like who's been on recently and who's coming up, and also like all our thoughts and feelings that you're so interested in. Okay, link in bio for that. We're on social media at Basic Folk Pod, TikTok, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube. Find us there. And if you are a contributor to Basic Folk, you get a big old high five from us. We are a listener-supported podcast, so everything that we do is made possible by listeners. So thank you so much. You can make a contribution if you would like to at the link in the bio. You can go to basicfolk.com. You can either go to the donate button or the store button. You can get yourself a hand-knit Basic Folk beanie made by the podcast's mom, a.k.a. my mom. And that's about it. Okay, thank you very much. All right. Iowa folk music icon Greg Brown is living that retired life. After playing his farewell retirement concert in 2023, he's actually returned with a new book, Ring Around the Moon, a Songbook, which highlights a song selection personally picked by the songwriter himself, as well as family photos, personal anecdotes, and self-penned drawings. The book features a foreword by Seth Avid of the Avid Brothers, who calls Brown's songs plain-spoken expression of the nearly inexpressible. In our conversation, we touch on topics like inner peace, happiness, personal growth, and self-acceptance. He speaks of how art has impacted him in ways that the artist will never understand. He talks about what it's like to be on both the receiving and sending end of this exchange, and that especially impacted him when he learned the poet Allen Ginsberg listened to an album of his while he was dying. I asked him about his music archives, which he calls a bunch of old notebooks on a shelf and a couple of boxes of old photos, which assisted him in recalling family connections for the songbook. Going through the photos and old songs instilled a sense of music nostalgia, including collaboration with Iowa musicians at the Wednesday night jam at the Mill. Music nostalgia surfaces several times through the pages, like his incredible story of founding the successful and beloved Red House Records. There's also a discussion on a few choice Greg Brown songs, like If You Don't Get It at Home, addressing replacing love for materialism and drug use. We talk about Brand New 64 Dodge, chronicling Brown's personal experience with JFK's assassination in 1963, and Two Little Feet, written in Alaska, where he was inspired by Native American myths he heard and felt in the area. Greg Brown's songbook was an awesome trip down memory lane for some of the best folk songs ever written from one very serious yet very silly songwriter. It was an honor to dig in with one of the best to do it. We'll hear a clip from what I think is Greg Brown's ultimate song, The Poet Game, and then we'll get to our conversation with Greg Brown on Basic Folk.
Down by the river, junior year, walking with my girl, and we came upon a place there in the tall grass where a couple had been making love. left the mark of their embrace. I said to her, looks like they had some fun. She said to me, let's do the same. And still I taste her kisses and her freckles in the sun when I play the poet game. Young man down in the hill country in the year of 22. He went to meet his future bride.
Greg Brown, Let's Party. This is going to be so great. I know we've had a journey getting to this point in the interview, but like, I really am so thrilled to be speaking with you. And I am also, I'm also quite thrilled with myself, with my line of questioning. So let's do this. Are you ready?
All right. I'm ready. Yep.
Okay. All right. So, congratulations on your new book, Ring Around the Moon. It's a songbook. So I wanted to know, like, what has been your experience with musician and songwriter memoirs and songbooks? Like, do you like them, or did you use any as a model or inspiration for your book?
I've looked at very few of them, I have to say. Over the years, you know, if I wanted to learn somebody's songs like Hank Williams or different people, I would get a songbook. But I really, my contemporaries, or I really haven't looked at many of their books, so I just kind of started on mine.
How did you decide how the flow and layout of the book would go? Because it's, like, really unique, the way it's all laid out.
Well, that's my friend Mei-Ling Shaw, who did all the layout and the design and everything. She did a great job. All I basically did was write a bunch of little prose pieces. And I wrote all those songs, of course. And
yeah, you did.
And then I did a few little drawings, and I had some photos around. So I just gave Mei-Ling all that stuff, and she put it all together.
Oh, it's excellent. So how did this process get you into that kind of, like, archival mind? Like, do you have an archive or a journal? And it sounds like you wrote all these stories fresh. Like, were your photos all organized? What was that archive like for you?
No, none of that. My archive, such as it would be, is a bunch of old notebooks on a shelf. That have, you know, where I wrote songs and so forth. And there was, I had a couple boxes of old photos I went through. That was my archive. Yeah, I'm not a real organized guy. I've recorded several songs over the years that I discovered looking through old notebooks. And then I'd see a song and I'd think, oh, and I didn't ever do anything with that one. So that's, I've done quite a few. There's a song called Tender Hearted Child that I found in an old notebook, and I had just been sitting there for years. But I've got a good memory for melodies, so I remember the tune for it. So,
oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
When you were going through all these notebooks and photos, like, what was that process like for you to look at all these, photos and these writings and stuff? Second part of this question, I know you're retired, but if you have found enough songs, maybe you might be inspired to make another record.
Oh, I have plenty of songs for quite a few more records if I still wanted to record, but I really don't want to do much more recording, I don't think. It was fun. You know, it's just like anybody sitting around in the afternoon looking at some old photos. It's a little nostalgic, you know, and you have a few memories, and then that's that.
Well, I have some specific questions about some specific reflecting that you may have done during this process. So this is a little bit of a setup here. You were raised in rural Iowa. Music was a huge part of your family life. You wrote in your book that your friend, the folklorist, painter, musician Art Rosenbaum, once visited your family. And he played music with your grandparents and was, like, seemingly blown away by your musical roots. And there's this, like, very precious photo of you and your grandpa Harold smiling at the camera. He has his banjo.
Yeah, yeah.
I feel like in the book you did a really great job of giving us a sense of like what music was like for you growing up. So like when putting together pictures and stories from your family for this book, like what was it like for you to reflect specifically on those family times now that you're like at the end, this end of your life?
The family ties, that's just in me every day. I mean, the people you love and people you grew up with, they're in you. So most of them I like having around, I would say. I was raised not just in Iowa, but also in southern Missouri and southern Kansas. When my dad was a preacher, he was from southern Missouri. And we spent about 5 years down in a town called Parsons, Kansas, just north of the Oklahoma border. So that was all important to me too. All those times.
Seth Avitt wrote the foreword of the songbook and had some very nice things to say. I really liked that he called your songs plain spoken expression of the nearly inexpressible. So expressing how you feel is really hard for a lot of people. How has it been for you, and how do you think your writing has contributed to your ability to express and talk about your feelings?
Yeah, I don't really know. Seth is a very nice young man, and he got in touch with me. He did a recording of a bunch of my songs. Seth came and saw me a couple times. Really, really nice fellow. And he agreed to write that piece for the songbook, which I thought was very nice. But yeah, what was the other part of that question?
It was about talking about your feelings, which you're avoiding right now.
No. No, I think that all came very naturally. I started writing poems and then songs when I was very young. It just seemed to be a very natural thing for me to do. I'm like anybody else, many times I can't say there's something I'd like to get at, but I can't really quite get at it. But I think songwriting, any kind of writing you do, the longer you do it and the harder you do it, it sort of takes on its own life. It becomes a part of your life when you're trying to write these things. And I enjoyed that whole process. I always kept a lot of journals. I'm a little unique maybe in that I like to fill up a journal and then throw it away. I don't like to keep that stuff around, really. Well, that's just the way I go about it. I'm just saying the same thing over and over. So once one's full, I let it go.
Is it just like personal journals, or are there like a bunch of Greg Brown songs sitting in the garbage?
No, I try to keep a hold of most of the songs. I certainly throw a lot of song lyrics away, but I try to. The journal is more like just kind of I did this today, or then it might go off into reflections on songs or anything else. Yeah.
Not only are you known for your reverence in songwriting, but for the humor that shows up in your music, it seems very singular. Seth Avitt writes that your work presents the human experience through universal reverence and easy humor. Where did your sense of humor come from? Like, where was it for you growing up?
My grandpa's a very funny guy. My mother's father, he was very funny. And my dad's whole side of the family, he had six brothers and a sister. They were great storytellers too, and I remember that from being a kid. And the Southern Missouri humor was a little more dry, a little more, you had to listen a little closer. But there was a lot of that in my family, just that storytelling and people with a good sense of humor.
How hard is it for you to be like both serious and silly, and like where has that showed up for you throughout your life?
I'm probably the worst person to ask. I mean, I know sometimes I'm serious and I know sometimes I'm silly, but as you know, those things just come and go like a breeze through the window. So we're all made the way we are, and some, I think for me, some people are overly serious, I would say. And some people are maybe overly silly, but that's all up to them. We each get through the best we can.
Which side of the scale do you fall on?
I think I'm more silly than serious, I would have to say.
Okay.
Yeah.
I like that. All right. You dedicate this book to your mom, Mary Olive. How do you say her last name?
Schjos. It's Norwegian. Schjos, K-J-O-S. Yeah.
Okay. There's this epic picture of her in your dedication. Yeah. She's a young woman, black and white photo. She's in a polka dot sundress, saddle shoes, swinging an axe right by a huge pile of wood.
Yeah.
What made you select that photo, and how do you think it sets the tone for the book?
Well, I thought that was a real good picture of Ma. And she was one of her chores down there. She did a lot of wood splitting.
How old is she in that photo?
16. And she's 95 now. So that's quite a while ago. But yeah, that picture's got a lot of, I would say, humor and emotion and respect. It's a good photo. Yeah.
It's a really good photo. Yeah. And we'll send her our best wishes from us. Yeah.
Nice. Yeah.
In the book, you wrote about your dad. So a little bit of a setup here in this question. You wrote about your dad after he praised you. You had a sold out show and you wrote, "He never criticized me really when I was growing up, but he was a little worried about how I was going to be able to take care of myself. So it was nice to get that affirmation from Pa. Some people never do." So recently, yeah, that really resonated with me, because recently my dad sent me this greeting card that basically said everything that I've ever wanted to hear from him, and it like truly left me gobsmacked.
Yeah.
Can you talk about what a gift it was to have a father who would tell you that he loved you and was proud of you, and how that impacted what kind of father you are?
I think that had a big effect. And I think that's a big question, but I think the way we confront our parents, mothers and fathers, is important. We have to express our needs, and we have to respect their needs. And but, you know, I've known a lot of men who never really got that nod from the dad. You know, Pa just saying, "I love you and you're doing fine." And I think that's very important. I know it's important to me to get that. My mother was probably a little too approving. You know, I couldn't draw a doodle without it being, "Oh, this is so great." And Pa was slower with that stuff, but he did. I remember I wrote a song called "Billy from the Hills," which was about him. And after that, when he would come to my show, I would often ask him if he'd like to get up and introduce me, or me and Bo. And he'd always walk out and say, "I'm Billy from the Hills." He'd use that song. So, yeah.
Did he have a similar speaking voice to you?
Pa, I probably have a similar speaking voice to him. I mean, he was a good singer. He led the singing in church. And, he's probably... He had a lot more of that Southern Missouri kind of lilt or whatever that is, than I do. But pretty similar. Mm-hmm. We looked alike too. We really pictures of us. We looked pretty similar, really.
Yeah, that's why. Yeah. Isn't that wild to like look exactly like a parent? Yeah.
Well, I didn't look exactly. I think it is a little weird when children look exactly like their parents.
Yeah.
You could tell he was my dad, that's for sure.
My dad, like, my brother is, like, looks exactly like my dad. Like, little kid pictures of my dad, it's just, like, so striking. It's wild.
Yeah, wow.
So there are great family photos in the book, as well as photos documenting the Iowa music scene taken by Sandra Dias,
right. Yeah, Dias. Sandy Dias,
So there's only four photos from her in there, but it seems like she's been documenting you all for a while. In 2007, she released a photo book called "Down to the River, Portraits of Iowa Musicians."
Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah, great.
And
book.
There seems like a really special vibe to the Iowa musicians that you have played and jammed with. So what was it like to have someone there to document it all, like Sandra?
You know, everybody got so used to her being around at gigs and stuff. one nice thing, you know, a lot of people, if they're getting their picture taken, they might get a little self-conscious or, but Sandy was just one of us. So the pictures she took were, had a lot of life in them, and everybody was relaxed with her because she was there so often.
Yeah. She becomes part of the fabric.
Yeah. Yeah. She really did. She still is. Yeah.
You tell a few stories about trying to make it in music, and you finally say, I got a pretty good look at the music business, and I wasn't too impressed, so I started my own label, which is, of course, the beloved Red House Records that you started in 1983, and it's still going on today. And I feel like many people in your position would have just, like, pursued the shiny thing and, like, would have been, like, bamboozled by, you know, whatever scheme was happening. So can you talk about your intuition and how it's guided your career, like, how you had the foresight to do your own thing at a time where people were not starting their own record labels?
Well, you know, one thing was nobody, when I was at that point, I started thinking about recording. I sent a demo tape out to the smaller, medium-sized labels there were at the time. And everybody, well, not everybody, but most of them said, yeah, this is really good. How much touring are you doing? And I said, no, I'm not a whole lot. And they said, well, if you were touring more, we'd probably make a record. And I said, well, if you'd record me, I could probably tour more. So kind of a, whatever you call it, catch-22. But when it comes to music and writing, I never wanted anybody advice or feelings. That's fine, but I didn't want anybody telling me, you know, record this song, don't record. That's all my business. So that's one thing I liked about having my own label. I had absolute freedom to do whatever I wanted to. A guy named Bob Feldman, who has since passed away, he's the one that took the label over and really turned it into a bona fide label. And by the way, Red House is done. I mean, his wife sold the label to an outfit called Compass Records, which is in Nashville. And they still distribute some Red House records. I don't know, they're probably about to run out, I would think. But anyway, yeah, it was Bob's the one that really made it into a nice little label. And I really enjoyed the freedom of, I decided at some point to record a lot of poems by William Blake, and not a lot of labels probably would have let me do
right,
that, but
right.
I had the freedom. I could say, I want to do this, and I would do it, so.
This is great, because my very next question is about the William Blake record, and in you sending that record to Allen Ginsberg.
Oh, yeah.
That record from 1985. So you wrote about this in the book, which I thought was, let me just set it up for people who are not familiar. So you sent the record to Allen Ginsberg. You never heard back until after he died. His secretary wrote to you and told you that he listened to that record a lot and asked to actually hear it while he was dying.
Yeah.
And you shared, this is a quote from the book, I think that's one of the really important things about music. It can mean so much for people who you've never met. So you must have also had those experiences where you were touched by music and art.
Oh, yeah.
And the creator never knew about
sure.
it. So how does, like, being on both ends of this make you reflect on being, like, both a sender and a receiver?
Well, I'm really glad Charlie Patton was alive on this planet and that he did some recording, as well as many, many other musicians that... you know, they had died before I was born. I think that helps the link of the music that came before and the music that's happening now. It helps that whole thing along. It's a kind of, I can't imagine not ever having heard the Carter Family, you know, but I got to, and a lot of that's a beautiful thing about music and recording is that it's a great way to learn about what was going on before. And then your own records, you hope, will be part of what's going on for the younger people now.
Yeah.
Well, I have to say one thing I worry about with the younger musicians these days is when I was out working, I would sell at first records and then tapes and then CDs. And that, as for musicians, that was a big part of my income. That really helped me keep going. And now with streaming, the younger musicians, they don't have that, and it's a lot harder deal for younger musicians going out trying to get started, and they're not making any money from CDs because streaming pays. Really, it's like streaming is like if you asked a plumber to come over and fix your sink, and he did, and then he gave him a nickel. That just ain't going to work for too long, you know. And so I'm concerned about what's happening with musicians and their ability to make a living.
Yeah, I agree with you. And my co-host of this podcast is Lizzie No, who is a singer-songwriter and often talks about how it's like unsustainable. It's nearly unsustainable.
It very nearly is. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's kind of up to music listeners, music fans, to stand up for who they really want to support, whether it's like people have Patreons or actually buying the merch, you know, like you actually have to be an active part of the fan base that way.
Yeah. There are people that are trying to help that along, but, you know, I wouldn't mind it if we had a much stronger, much bigger musicians union and had some power where we could say, hey, guess what? If we're not getting paid, we're not going to work.
We're not going to play. Yeah, we're not going to work.
Of course, very few of us musicians can afford to do that. But I think there needs to be some speaking up for musicians and for what's happening with the corporations just taking that whole thing over.
Yeah.
You know, throwing out a few pennies.
Long overdue.
Yeah.
Well, this seems like a good idea, a good time to bring up your handwriting. Your handwriting and drawings are all over this book in pen and pencil, some watercolors too. Mm-hmm. Your style of handwriting and drawing are lovely. What do you think of your drawing and writing style, and how does it parallel your music?
You know, I don't know. I've always called my little drawings, I call them doodles. And people say, I'll put one in a letter or something, you know, and people say, oh, I like that. And I go, what? They just look like little scribbles to me. But I mean, I enjoy doing them or I wouldn't do them. But that was just, I think I did that too from the time I was little. I remember I would draw little kind of cartoons all the time. And sometimes I think I should have tried being a cartoonist. Maybe I will. I'm retired from music now, so.
Do what you want.
Yeah.
Unless you decide to record another Greg Brown album with songs from the trash.
That'd be a good title. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, I'll tell you, one of my songs is called Rex Roth's Daughter. And that's on an album way back. But I was working on that song, and I must have done 12 or 15 versions of it. And I just got very frustrated. I couldn't get the thing going, and I threw it in the trash. And my middle daughter, Consti, came in, and she looked in the trash. A day or two later, she saw these notes of mine, you know, scrawlings sticking out, and she read them. She came out to the kitchen, and she said, Dad, you got to finish this song. So when your daughter tells you to do that, I went ahead and I never did feel like I got that song quite right, but, you know, at least it got out there a little bit.
Yeah, at least she took it out of the trash. Wow, what an incredible story. So this is a question about throwing things away. One thing I feel like I gather from listening to your lyrics and looking at pictures in this book is that you don't like to have a lot of stuff. and you don't like a lot of stuff. You talk about having too many guitars. You label a picture notebooks that I didn't throw out. We just found out in this interview that you would throw notebooks away after you filled them up. And you have lines in your songs. Like, one of my favorites is, children don't need a lot of stuff, but they sure do need a lot of love.
Yeah.
So, Greg, what is your relationship to stuff?
Well, I think, like a lot of people, I mean, I've got a lot of books. You know, I've got way more books than I need. I've got more shoes than I need, too. Sometimes we just love, I mean, I'm like anybody else. There's certain things that, hats, I've got too many hats. But I do recycle everything, pretty much. Like, a lot of my clothes I get at the Goodwill. And then after a while, I take them back to the Goodwill, and I get some different clothes. So, but yeah, in terms of... I'm not a big fan. I mean, I think America has kind of gone overboard with all the materialism. I don't think any of us need probably as much stuff as we have, and other people don't have what they do need. So, yeah, I do like getting rid of things. Some people I know, they clean out their basement or something, and they really have a hard time, you know, letting go of this or that or that, and I really don't. I mean, I could have my favorite shirt on and go somewhere and leave it, and I would never think of it again.
Wow.
It's just...
strong.
Yeah.
Strong feelings.
Well, yeah, and also kind of like just not paying too much attention to stuff, I guess. Although, like I say, I do like my books and my fishing rods and my shoes.
What advice would you give to somebody who's having a hard time getting rid of their stuff?
Well, you know... If you've got some time and a couple matches.
All right. Okay. I have some questions about some specific songs that show up in this songbook. But I do want to say that I was like kind of bummed that there wasn't any songs from your record you made with Bill Morrissey.
Oh,
which
yeah.
I know people are sad that songs aren't included in here. But that was, I just wanted to report to you that that was mine.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Maybe like Fishing with Bill or something.
Oh, sure, yeah, yeah. Yeah, you know, when I went to pick out the songs for the book, I went through my recordings, and I tried to pick some from different times, you know. So a couple songs from that album, that's the way I went about it. And I didn't want it to be too many songs, so it's only 40.
Right.
Songs all together.
Must have been hard.
There was kind of a limit set right there, but I enjoyed the whole thing and found a nice guy to do the notation, and yeah, it just kind of gradually developed.
Okay, here's a question about Brand New 64 Dodge.
Uh-huh.
This song is the experience of a young teenage boy right before the shit hits the fan with JFK's assassination in 1963. So doing the math, this seems like this is your experience.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, it was.
How has writing this song, living with it for 30 years, impacted the way you think about how national and global tragedies impact young people?
Well, they do. And there's so many of them now, and so many of them are so sad. They have a huge impact on everybody, young and old. I wrote that song. I was going across an airport. I don't remember where I was. I'd been thinking of the song for a while. All I had was Money Comes Out of Dad's Billfold, Hanky's Come Out of Mom's Purse. That's all I had. And I'd been carrying that around for a while, and then I'm walking across this airport, and I heard the whole song, just all at once,
wow.
The whole thing. So I sat down, got out my notebook, I wrote out the songs, and I just barely made my flight. But that's one of those songs that just, a lot of songs are like that. You have a seed or you have a little thing, and then you carry it around, and then all of a sudden it pops out.
Mm.
That was my experience, and that was the car we had, a brand new 64 Dodge.
Wow.
It was baby blue. But, yeah, that's the way that happened.
Wow.
Yeah.
Incredible song. Incredible story about writing that one, too. Okay, the next question is about if you don't get it at home. So you write about what children need, what a partner or lover needs, where you don't find love in drugs and alcohol. Even if you're bent, a strong wind of real love will straighten you right back up. So, man, this song is so good. And it seems like it could have like been even longer. Mm-hmm. So how did you choose to focus on these four verses to get the point across?
Well, that's the way my songs work. It's like they kind of call the shots. You know, I remember I wrote that song and that felt like it was done. And when a lot of times when you feel like a song is done, it's done. And yes, it's a matter of singing songs too. I mean, I know really long songs can work, ballads, different songs. But you got to find the way the song wants to be. And that song seemed to want to be that way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I like that song, too. If you don't get it at home, you're going to go looking. I think that's true.
Yes. All right. The next question I have is about a specific line in the song, Two Little Feet.
Uh-huh.
You said, I hear the voice of the ancient ones chanting magic words from a different time.
Yeah.
Some real witchy shit right there.
yeah.
I was like, I went to England last year and like was on the hunt for anything like pagan or druid. And then revisiting that song and hearing that line, like it stuck out to me and it made me wonder, like, who are these ancient magic people that you're talking about?
In that song, I wrote that song up in Alaska at a roadside cafe on the Kenai Peninsula. But I think I was definitely thinking of old Native American stories, myths. I've always been interested in those things. And that's specifically what that was referring to. I hear the voice mm-hmm. of the ancient ones, those old stories, the old songs, the old myths, and those things. Particularly if you can be in some place where nature hasn't been completely driven to its knees, you can feel more of that. I could feel that. Up in Alaska.
Yeah. It is wild how you can go to a certain area and feel like the spirit, the palpable spirit.
Yeah.
I've never been to Alaska, but I feel that way about like the Joshua Tree in California, like that area.
Yeah.
New Orleans, like the Riviera Maya in Mexico.
Yeah.
And England.
Uh-huh.
Which is kind of wild, but awesome.
Yeah, right. The spirits are stronger in some place. I've always remembered the first time I went to Alaska. It was kind of a foggy, rainy day, as it often is up there. But I was driving, and I was getting fairly close to Mount Denali, I'd say within 30 miles. And I couldn't see it. It was the mist and the rain. You couldn't, but I could feel the mountain.
Wow.
I could feel the mountain. And I was driving around, I thought, I can feel that mountain. And, you know, another 10 or 15 miles, the clouds parted a little bit, and there it was.
What did the mountain feel like?
It feels like muddy water singing.
Ooh. Wow. Okay, one more question.
Okay.
And then you can get on with your life.
Okay.
All right. In The Poet Game, you write about romantic love, friend love, and love of country. And of love of country, you say, I watch my country turn into a coast-to-coast strip mall.
Uh-huh.
I cried out in song, if we could do it all in 30 years, then please tell me, why does good change take so long? So, that song is 30 years old.
Uh-huh.
It's from 30 years ago. So if you don't mind sharing, what does your love of country look like in 2024?
Boy, I'm pretty much in despair about our country right now. I just, the things we're doing around the world, the people that are running for office, just the sheer hatred in the political environment. I'm very worried about this country and around the world, too. It's certainly... to me, it's just appalling what's really going on. I just hope, and I hang on to my hope the best I can.
Mm. Well, Greg Brown, I lied to you because we have to do the lightning round.
Okay.
And then you can get on with your life.
Okay.
All right, here we go. Greg Brown, what is the song that will definitely get you on the dance floor?
Oh, anything by Mavis Staples.
Ooh, all right. As a person who has grown up in the state of Iowa and spent a lot of time in the state of Iowa, please tell me, what is your favorite corn dish?
Oh, just sweet corn. We used to call them roasting ears back before the GMO stuff started. Field corn in Iowa, you could pick it when it was still fairly young. And we would pick it, we wouldn't shuck it, we'd build a fire, throw it with the husks on into the fire, and then that was called roasting ears. That was my favorite.
Ooh, that sounds good. Okay, of these two clothing brands, if you could only wear one for the rest of your life, would you select Carhartt or Dickies?
Oh, boy. I think I'd go with Dickies.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. Surprise. Yeah. Surprise. All right. Good to know. All right. Who is your guitar hero?
Malcolm Holcomb was a friend of mine who just passed away in March.
Yeah.
Malcolm was my favorite guitar player ever.
Mm. Okay, Greg, what is your current favorite hat? Oh, yeah. That's a good one.
Yeah,
a good sun hat.
Changes from day to day. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Money is no object, dead or alive. Who is your dream backing band?
Oh, wow. All the people I would pick, I that has to be quite a fantasy because, it would probably be Ollie Farquhar Touré. Oh, that's, there's so many. I don't think I could narrow it down. I liked all the musicians that played in the band, but there's so many great musicians. I don't know. I'll have to think about that one.
Okay. Let me tell you my dream backing band. So Jay Belarose is on drums.
Uh-huh.
That's it.
Oh, that's it. Okay.
That's the only one. That is a hard question. Maybe
When you said that, I would have Thelonious Monk on piano for sure.
Okay, that's a good one. I would maybe get Jay Belarose on drums, Steve Winwood on keys.
Well, he's Stevie Winwood. He's such a great singer, too.
Oh, yeah. But, yeah, maybe he should sing instead of me. That might be a good idea.
Yeah.
All right, that seems like a good band. All right, this is the last one. Thank you so much for taking all this time with me today. Where is the most beautiful place in the world?
Well, I'd say it's wherever you feel relaxed and reasonably happy. That can be a lot of different places. Our main job here, it seems to me, is try to get... Well, like Merle Haggard says, learning to live with myself. If you can do that, then anywhere you go, you're gonna be feeling fairly good. But if you don't get there, it doesn't matter where you go.
Awesome answer. Thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for putting up with all my technological idiocy.
I would do it anytime.
I hope you got some.
This episode was produced by CJ Nungesser. Alex Stanton composes our music. Basic Folk is on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network. You can find all of our episodes there, wherever you get podcasts. You can search for us on the SiriusXM app under Basic Folk. You can find us on FolkAlley.com or on Folk Alley's mobile app. Or you can go to our website, BasicFolk.com. If you enjoyed this episode, perhaps you should share it with a friend. Like maybe your friend that you found out was born in Iowa, and then you started awkwardly singing Dar Williams' Iowa to them, and it seemed as though it was a really good response, but their face was blank. And, you could send them this episode to show them what you're kind of talking about, even though it's Greg Brown and not Dar Williams. send it to that person. Okay, thanks for checking out the pod, and we'll talk to you next time. Bye.